Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. Christiana Figueres is a Costa Rican diplomat with 35 years of experience in high-level national and international policy and multilateral negotiations. She was appointed Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in July 2010, 6 months after the failed COP15 in Copenhagen. During the next 6 years, she dedicated herself to rebuilding the global climate change negotiating process based on fairness, transparency, and collaboration, leading to the 2015 Paris Agreement, widely recognized as a historical achievement. Over the years, she has worked in the fields of climate change, sustainable development, energy, land use, technical and financial cooperation. Figueres was recently named one of the top 100 most influential people in climate change policy. She also co-hosts a podcast called Outrage and Optimism. I met up with Figueres at Collision, a high-tech conference, during a Q&A session.
Most, I suppose, famous and celebrated speaker is a question of your very own. It is my great privilege to welcome to the stage the woman whose stubborn, I suppose, really, optimism led to the 2015 Paris Agreement. Without further ado, please welcome Christiana Figueres to the stage.
Thank you, Lucien.
So, the very first question that I selfishly would like to ask you is, what do you feel is the impact of the fact that America has withdrawn under President Trump from the Paris Agreement?
Okay, Lucia, first of all, let's get our terminology correct.
Sure.
What do you mean by America? America is a continent. In fact, it is three continents. North America, Central America, South America, for a total of more than 20 countries. Which country are you talking about? Or are you talking about all countries?
The United States of America.
Aha! Okay. That's actually an important point, right? It's an important point because that is a country. So, a couple of things about that. First, that barring a re-election, and we have no idea what's going to happen next year, but barring a re-election, the negative impact of what I call the dark house, translation, White House without any lights on any topic. So the damage that the dark house is doing onto climate change is actually relatively less than the damage that it is doing to the social fabric in the United States and around the world. That is a sad statement. The other point is that besides, you know, rolling back, and today I flew here reading on the first page of the New York Times that they're not going to roll back EPA interpretation of what is harmful so that they can then put more coal onto the system, because now all of a sudden air pollution is not causing deaths. Really? How about 7 million people dying because of air pollution in the entire world? So that all of those rollbacks are actually quite dangerous, but what is fascinating is that as they try to roll back regulations and policies here on the other side, taking the left lane and going much faster is the real economy in the United States. And so you have more and more corporations, hopefully many of those that you work for, many more corporations, as well as state governments, as well as city governments, actually decarbonizing either their company or their state and city, because they understand it's good for them. Yes, of course, they will also, as a corollary, help to save the planet, but that's not the point. They are doing it because it's good for them. So that's an interesting point. Now, to the humor of all of this, because the universe is very humorous. from a legal perspective, the United States of America as a single country that has actually already signed on to the Paris Agreement and made it a law in the United States cannot legally leave the Paris Agreement until the 6th of November of 2020. And the date of the election in the United States is the 3rd of November of 2020. So we don't know what is going to happen on the 3rd of November. But you know, at least there's some chance that the U.S. would pull out under a newly elected president who could then reinstall the United States into the Paris Agreement. So, summa summarum, I'm not terribly worried about it. Now, with a re-election, then my concern would go up because 8 years of rolling back policies could actually be quite harmful. But that's where we are for the time being. Delphine, you have the most difficult question, so go at it right now.
Thank you so much. I'm Li Chen. So simply from all of us, thank you so much for being here. So here's my question, since you're a very optimistic person. Do you really believe that the Paris Agreement can succeed or even survive when we are currently in a way where countries are turning their back to it and embracing a path of populism and liberal economy being replaced by protectionism?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question, Bruce. It's a very good question. Now, two things to that. First of all, yes, the Paris Agreement is moving forward, and we will see next year, at the end of next year, which is when all countries have to come back to the table to report on what they have been able to do based on advancing technology, shifting capital, and improved regulation and policies, and then they would have, under the Paris Agreement, the obligation to increase the ambition that they have right now. So that remains to be seen. I happen to know that China and India have actually already not just complied with what they said they were going to do under the Paris Agreement, they have actually already over-complied. So from a technical point of view, China and India could already take on higher ambition, which is what they need to do. Politically, will they do so well? That really depends on other countries, because you can understand that from a political point of view, countries kind of look over their shoulders to see what everyone else is doing. So there is a rather yes and no, touch and go on whether countries as governments would be able to come up with higher ambition. Setting that aside, we go to the real economy, and the fact is that we are, especially now, despite the fact that last year we had global emissions go up by 1.7%, despite that, we are seeing an immense rush to exit coal, which is the highest polluting greenhouse gas, or the highest polluting fossil fuel that has the highest carbon content. And the reason why coal is actually on the demise is because A, nobody wants it in their backyard because it is the most polluting fuel that we ever had, and who wants to breathe that polluted into the air? B, because it's actually losing value. And so you have a growing number of banks, certainly all the development banks, but also increasingly private banks that are actually pulling out of financing coal because as an asset it is losing its value. And the winner now is that insurance companies are beginning to say it is such a risk that we can no longer offer insurance policies to coal plants or to coal mines. Now, in all of the sectors that we know, who are the ones who are the risk gurus? Who do we give our money to so that they can manage our risk? The insurance companies, right? So if the insurance companies are actually pulling out of coal, that should send a pretty tough message that that coal is increasingly losing not just its social license because of the pollution, but its financial license. So we will see the effect of that pulling out of coal that is happening this year. We will see that next year when we quantify emissions. So I am still very hopeful that we will be on track by 2020 to begin the descent of emissions, which is what science is actually demanding. On the other side, I have to say, amazing what is happening on renewable energy, amazing what is happening on electric vehicles, amazing what is happening on battery and storage, and all of those technologies that are in the solution space are actually picking up on the exponential curve. Solar is already definitely on the high part of that curve. Wind is there. Electric vehicles are still on the, if you think about, you know, exponential curve that starts all the way down here and then goes up. So you have electric vehicles that are still down here, but you see the projection that is going up, and then batteries will be the next wave in. So you can imagine, right? And that's the fun thing about decarbonizing our economy. You can imagine that 20 years from now, those kids will say, you did what? You put a liquid into cars? Now, what was that liquid? That will not be, they won't even conceive that yet. Just like my daughter said, you did what? You used a mainframe computer in college? What the hell is that? So we are moving forward with technology advance so quickly, that we will just have a completely different world. And that is the exciting thing about decarbonizing the economy. Hi, Alessandra Guerra from Norway. So Paris Agreement is a political thing that took a long time to achieve. And we're here at a tech conference. And we have wonderful solution providers like Norway who are trying to be as quick as possible to meet our deadline of 12 years in climate action. But how do we best engage with policymakers who are setting the drivers, especially when it comes to stakeholders like the private sector, to act on climate? How can we close that feedback loop so we get quick climate action? Very good question. And I have the sense, and I could be dead wrong, but I have the sense that the way that this has worked in the past, certainly the way it worked when we were creating the environment to adopt the Paris Agreement, that it was actually the private sector, finance, investors, as well as the entire capital market sector, that were the ones who were on the front foot. And what they did was provide the government with the context that told governments, no matter what, where they looked, they saw that the private sector in all different spaces, in transportation, in energy, in health, in land use, all of those sectors were actually raring to go because they wanted the certainty of an agreement. And so while for 3 or 4 years before the Paris Agreement, the push came from the private sector, then it was picked up, if you will, by the public sector in the Paris Agreement, and then governments took that wave that was coming from the private sector and planted the flag way in front, right? Because they went for a very ambitious agreement and they said, by 2050, we will have a carbon neutral global economy. That was way far ahead than the private sector had ever imagined. So now picture that we're actually going around that again, okay? So it is a spiral, if you will. Once that flag is planted by the public sector, now it goes back to the private sector to say, okay, you know, as long as we know that long term, yes, of course, with a whole bunch of stuff that is happening now, but long term, we're going to a decarbonized economy. So we, the private sector, are putting our eyes on that. That's where we're going. And that impetus will then be reflected, hopefully, next year by governments, and then the spiral goes around. So you can see that it's a spiral that goes, you know, it's not just flat. If you can think of it as a three-dimensional spiral that continues to go up and up and up and up in terms of ambition of decarbonization. So I think that's where we are.
Hello, my name's Steve Morris. I'm from the UK. Admired your tenacity. And 18 months ago, I was lucky enough to go to spend some time in Costa Rica. And I was just blown away how that country is the rest of the world to shame when it comes to attitudes to environmentalism.
Well, we don't mean to shame anybody. We mean to inspire everyone.
How is the whole of Costa Rica, is the whole of Costa Rica, not just the president, everybody in Costa Rica, how did they manage to get their mentality to everybody being so committed to renewables and doing something about climate change. What lessons can we give the rest of the world?
Yeah, well, it's not something that occurs from Sunday night to Monday morning at 7 o'clock, right? We have been investing in this. To those of you who don't know, I'm from Costa Rica, wonderful little country. And we have been investing in this since the 70s, okay? In fact, let me go back. We have actually been investing in this since the 1940s, because in 1948, my father, thank heavens, led a successful revolution in defense of democracy, and one of the first things he did was get rid of the army and took the budget of the army and put it where? Into national parks and into the Ministry of Education. Smart thing to do. That's one thing that everybody else could do, right? And since then, we have actually had, as a country and as a culture and as a commitment, as a national commitment, a real commitment to invest in our national parks, to invest in the Ministry of Energy. We call ourselves a bio-literate, not just alphabetically. It's not just about maths and reading. We actually are bio-literate Costa Rican. We know our biodiversity. We're incredibly proud of it. And we have 25% of the territory in national parks. And we are the only country in the world that has actually turned the clock back on deforestation. We went all the way down to 21% forest cover. We're now all the way back up to 52% forest cover because it's important to our economy. We don't have any biofuels, we don't have any minerals, we don't have any metals. The richness that we have is our biodiversity, and that's why all of you want to come to Costa Rica to see the beautiful biodiversity. So we invest in it. But we also invest through the Ministry of Education. And so we have, you know, people who are actually very, very committed to our green spaces. And for the fourth time in a row, Costa Rica has been coming out in the happiness index way at the top as number one. And why is that? Number one, we don't have an army. Nobody has to go to the army. I'm a Costa Rican mother. I know that my children will never have to go to war. And number two, we are very, very close to nature. So. Yes, that is the inspiration that we would like to have for other countries.
My name is Jean-Marc from Canada. First of all, thank you so much for everything you've done. My question is, plastic pollution in the oceans right now seems to be reaching like a crisis level, but also it seems like governments are starting to step in and understand the problem. Do you have any advice for policies that governments can take to tackle this problem?
You know, I just came back from Kenya a few weeks ago, and I met the Minister of Environment, who used to be the Minister, she's now Ambassador in Paris. But she was the one who took the very courageous decision of saying, no more plastic bags, at least you started with bags. And she said, the best incentive to get rid of the damn plastic bags is put a fine. Now, it's not a $1 or $2, it's $400 if you're caught with a plastic bag in Kenya, okay? So she knew that that was going to be outrageous. She started with a much higher fine and then was negotiated down. But I'm telling you, there is no plastic bag in Kenya. In fact, when you land, you know, and all those planes are always full of plastic junk, when you land, the first thing they tell you is plastic bags are prohibited in Kenya. If you have one, please leave it on this airplane and we will take it back to where we came from. So, you know, now that is a really good incentive, right? Because here's the lesson. Put a price on what you don't want. Put a price on pollution, put a price on plastic, put a price on carbon. That's where we should be putting a price. Don't put a price on things that we do want, like work, right? And productivity. We should be putting a price on the things that we don't want. I am telling you, and Kenyans are so proud of it. They are so proud of the fact that they have now grown a whole domestic industry with alternative products that come from their natural fibers. And there are so many more people employed in the container business because they needed to very quickly actually substitute for plastic bags. And they're really, really proud that they are the only country in the world in which it is completely prohibited to have a plastic bag. So I'm taking that back to Costa Rica.
Hi, Christina. Thank you so much for being here. My name is Amy, and I'm from Canada. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on how we can better leverage Indigenous knowledge systems on climate transition and how we can do a better job in the future of kind of bringing those voices into conversation in the public
very important, because the fact is, you know, in this industrialization race, in fact, even in the technological race that we have initiated, let's call it 50 or 100 years ago, we decided unconsciously, sometimes consciously, to tramp over an incredible amount of knowledge and experience that is still being held by indigenous peoples. And if you have spent any time with these people, you know that they understand what is going on. You know that they really are very, very aware and very knowledgeable about everything that surrounds them, and that they know what plants they can use for what, etc. All of this knowledge we have completely ignored. And here's the question. Since we're in such a crisis about so many things, can we possibly afford to ignore the incredible encyclopedia of knowledge that is stored there? We just can't afford to do that. So it is time to go back to those people who have that much information and knowledge and experience, and that have handed it down generation to generation to generation, and to actually be able, instead of putting them out here, you know, sort of in the museum type approach, to bring them in and say, well, you know, what can we do? So, you know, for me, the fantastic example of that is everything to do with biomimicry, right? Because we're going back into nature using the technology that we have. It's not demonizing technology, good heavens no, but it's also not demonizing that. It's how do you bring both of those things together? How do you bring the understanding of nature and technology together so that we can actually create a better, safer world for everyone? So that's the marriage that I think we need to pursue.
Also at the Collision Tech Conference held in Toronto was another member of the top 100 climate change influencers, the Canadian Minister of Environment and Climate Change, Catherine McKenna. In that capacity, McKenna drove her country's efforts in ratifying the 2015 Paris Agreement. Since then, McKenna has been pushing the effort to establish a national carbon tax amid strong backlash from several provincial governments. At one session during the day, McKenna spoke about the fact that people should not rely on governments to do all the heavy lifting when it came to climate change mitigation, that everyone had a role to play. At a press conference, I had the chance to ask McKenna about her government's pledge to invest billions of dollars towards infrastructure and clean tech investment. I'll let you decide whether or not she answered my question.
About how we protect the planet, you guys are the inventors, the entrepreneurs, the innovators. You need to look at our challenges, and they are so big. We have so many challenges that you can reimagine how you use your technology to help us. But not just to help us, to help our kids. Because at the end of the day, is the last pitch I will have. It is all about our kids. That we owe it to our kids to figure this out, to ensure a sustainable planet. And we know the problem. We know many of the solutions. We know we can scale them. We know we can attract the financing. And Canada is certainly stepping up and playing a role. But for all of you folks, I don't care where you are from the world, help us. Help us. Because it's not just about governments negotiating agreements. It's actually about implementing solutions. And those are solutions that individuals can use. Those are solutions on a massive scale. Because it literally, our planet is burning. And we're all on this, together, so help us find the solutions.
We're more in our north. We have a biodiversity challenge. We're losing our nature, our animals, our plants, that we may be losing a million species. That's a huge problem. We also have our oceans, which are increasingly warming, acidifying, and are being filled with plastic pollution. I could go on. There are more challenges, but that's kind of my world. And it's interesting because I don't always think about the tech solutions that you can use to tackle these big challenges. But clearly, there's so many. So first of all, you need to look at how you're measuring. Measuring is critically important. You need to know what the baseline is. So there are companies like GHGSat. What do? They go and they can measure emissions from industry. So you actually know what are the real emissions from industry, not estimates. And then you can actually figure out, okay, well, if that's the GHG emissions, how are we going to tackle it? What are we aiming for? And then there's monitoring. We use a lot of different technologies, using AI, satellite, drones, to monitor species. So if you take the hairy caribou up in our north, that if you use satellite imagery, you can see where the caribou are going, you can see habitat, how the habitat is changing, what the impact is. You can also incorporate things like indigenous traditional knowledge. We work with Inuit in our high Arctic, which I think is also incredibly important. We can't just say it's all about tech, we're going to solve everything one app at a time. You still need good science, and you also have an opportunity with indigenous traditional knowledge to build on the knowledge that indigenous peoples have had for millennia. Citizen engagement, another great example. If we want people to care about protecting nature, we need to engage them. Many, many different examples of how you can do that. We actually have something that's very cool. People really like songbirds. So we have Canadians that upload songs from songbirds into a database, and we can track where the birds are going, what type of birds we're seeing, and citizens can really be part of it. So just a few examples, I mean, on climate change, clean tech, so many amazing examples out there. Carbon engineering, literally taking emissions from industry, so sucking CO2 out of the air, using it to create clean fuels. So awesome opportunities, and that's why I'm super excited to see Collision focus on the planet, because it's all hands on deck now. Our planet is literally burning, and we need to find solutions, and we need people to start linking the technology that's out there with the challenges we have to find the solutions we need. And I think that's a huge opportunity for the world, just to put it in an economic case, $26 trillion economic opportunity of clean technology solutions. We need them. And you guys have an opportunity to bring them to the world. Certainly, I'm focused on how do we make sure Canada is leading the way, both in finding the solutions we need, but also providing the technological innovation to create good jobs here in Canada. So I had to be really fast. I don't know. Any questions?
Hello, Minister. In 2015, when the Liberals were elected, they promised a massive influx of money for infrastructure. How much has been going to clean tech? What's been spent on clean tech?
So that's a really good question. I mean, we have many different ways that we flow money to clean tech, whether it's from SDTC, Sustainable Development Technology Canada, through EDC, through BDC. Historic investments have gone. I think we tried to quantify it because there's different ways you can look at it. I think we're at maybe $8 million, but the acceleration of investments and the way we are doing it, which is a different way through different partnerships, also investing in pure science, you need to be doing that too. But we're really seeing the dividends. Canada is now punching above its weight in terms of clean tech. I think we now have like 12 companies on the top 100 clean tech companies. And so we're seeing the benefits right now. And it's sometimes the small scale solutions we need to scale up. That's the financing piece is super important. Sometimes it's getting access to international markets. We saw we're the only country that has trade deals with the U.S. and Mexico, Asia through the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and also with Europe through the Canada-European Free Trade Agreement. We landed all three of those while a renegotiated NAFTA. Huge economic opportunities if you're based here. So it's not just financing, although I hear you, financing, investment in the entrepreneurs, the innovators, hugely important, but it's also access to markets that matter.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. I'd also like to encourage you to like, rate, and share Earth Matters with others so that our work can reach a larger audience. Thanks for listening.